It is Friday, February the 24th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, discussions underway in Mexico City about President Trump's proposed wall along the U.S.-Mexico border.
To the extent to which a wall is simply a metaphor for enhanced border security, where we may see some small sections of wall, but all that President Trump really does is enhance border security, that will have a negative impact, but not an overly negative impact.
Also ahead, Iraqis take control of Mosul's airport, that controversy over transgender rights in the U.S., and a preview of the upcoming Academy Awards. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Amid worries about a wall and deportation, Mexican officials expressed their concern to two U.S. cabinet secretaries, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Department of Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly spoke with their Mexican counterparts. As they left for Mexico City, White House spokesman Sean Spicer insisted U.S.-Mexican relations remain positive.
We have a very healthy and robust relationship with the Mexican government and Mexican officials, and I think they would echo that same sentiment. President Peña Nieto has echoed that as well. But I think the relationship with Mexico is phenomenal right now, and I think there's an unbelievable and robust dialogue between our two nations.
Rice University Latin American analyst Mark Jones speaks with VOA's Victor Beatty now about all of this.
The goal of Tillerson's trip was to improve and soften and try to smooth over the friction that's occurred previously in U.S.-Mexico bilateral relations. But just before he goes, the Trump administration releases this new memorandum that is seen as an affront to Mexican dignity, that representing hostility towards Mexico and Mexicans, both in terms of deportations in the United States, as well as the new policy to take any Central American migrant who crosses over from Mexico and not, as it has been the case, return them to Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, but instead to just drop them on the Mexican side of the border in Reynosa, Juarez, and elsewhere. I think for Rex Tillerson, this really is mission impossible. Kelly's trip to Guatemala, if you think of it from more of a public relations trip in terms of signaling to Guatemalans not to migrate illegally to the United States, there may be something to it in the sense that his presence there will resonate among some Guatemalans who might reconsider a trip to the United States in terms of paying coyote or smuggler $5,000 to $10,000 for a trip that may end up being futile.
Can this matter be resolved and still maintain good cross-border relations between the U.S. and Mexico?
To the extent to which the wall is simply a metaphor for enhanced border security, where we may see some small sections of wall, but all that President Trump really does is enhance border security, that will have a negative impact, but not an overly negative impact. Where I think we could start treading into very dangerous ground is if the president does go through with actually building a wall and tries to make Mexico pay either directly through sending them a bill or indirectly through some type of tax on imports from Mexico, a tax on remittances, or a suspension of aid to Mexico. We have to start looking a little further down the pike about what this means for the future of U.S.-Mexico relations in regard to the 2018 Mexican presidential election. Because what we've seen is, since the election of President Trump in November, a very radical populist candidate on the left wing, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has seen his stock rise. He's gone from being roughly third in the polls to first in the polls.
That is Rice University Latin American analyst Mark Jones speaking with my colleague, Victor Beatty. Following the Trump administration's rollback of U.S. federal guidelines telling public schools to let transgender students use restrooms and locker rooms matching their chosen gender identity, there is a lot of confusion and uncertainty about that issue. We're joined now by International Edition's Lori London to talk about all of this. Lori?
Well, Steve, the Trump administration is arguing that this is an issue that should be left to individual states to decide. And I thought it would be a good idea to talk more about it with someone who knows the legal ins and outs. I'm joined by labor and employment attorney Thomas Wassell with the New York-based firm Cullen & Dykman to explain exactly what does this new administration order mean.
There's a federal law that relates to sexual equality and other gender issues in education. It's known as Title IX of the Education Act. And last year, the Obama administration issued something that's called a Dear Colleague letter. This is often how the federal agencies give advice. And in the Dear Colleague letter, they gave guidance that said that Title IX, which does clearly prohibit sex discrimination, but that it applied to transgender students. Transgender students are not specifically mentioned in Title IX, but they were interpreting it as applying it to transgendered students. What has now happened is the Trump administration has issued new guidance, essentially rescinding or withdrawing this other guidance. So now there is no guidance specifically as to whether Title IX covers transgendered students.
Is it just about which bathrooms they should use?
No, not at all. Title IX covers everything. Title IX is often cited and used in terms of sports teams. It's the law that requires that schools spend comparable amounts of money on women's teams as well as men's teams, things like that. It applies to locker rooms. It applies to all sorts of gender issues at schools. And basically, the rescinding of the guidance basically now is that the federal government, the Justice and Education Department, I don't know that they're taking the position that it doesn't apply to transgendered, but they have withdrawn the guidance that says that it does.
So what policies do school districts around the country have at the moment regarding students that are transgender?
There's a wide variety. In many of the big cities, I would probably have to say in the blue states, there are policies that quite clearly protect transgendered students and provide that they have the right to use the bathroom of the gender with which they identify. You know, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and a number of cities have rules like that. But at the same time, there are many school districts that have the opposite approach. In fact, there's a case that's going to the Supreme Court right now involving a student at a high school in Virginia where the school district basically said that this transgendered male can't use the boys' restroom, and that's going to the Supreme Court.
So really it's an issue in our country that sounds like it hasn't been resolved.
Well, yeah, there is a case going to the Supreme Court right now. It's scheduled to be argued. It's and in fact, oral argument in that is scheduled for March 28th. So the thing is, many of the laws that discuss discrimination discuss it in somewhat specific terms, but not necessarily all encompassing. For example, Title VII, which is the federal anti-discrimination statute that applies to employment, says that you can't discriminate on the basis of sex. It doesn't say anything about sexual harassment. However, the courts and later on Congress found that sexual harassment was a type of discrimination on the basis of sex. It's a matter of interpretation. Same thing is true for Title IX. It doesn't specifically in its terms address transgendered students, but it does prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex or gender. So the question is, does that encompass transgendered students? And it'll be up to the courts, it appears, to decide that, since I don't believe there's any realistic possibility that Congress is going to specifically amend Title IX.
What do you expect will likely happen next for transgender student rights?
Well, if in fact the Supreme Court upholds the rights of this student in Virginia and basically says that Title IX does cover transgendered students, that would be a significant victory, and it would end the debate unless Congress wants to pass a law specifically saying that transgendered students are not covered by Title IX. If the Supreme Court interprets it as being covered, that's the end of the inquiry unless the law gets changed. Many people argue that this should be that each state should make the decision here. So in fact, some of the talk out of the Trump administration was that this should be a state issue. That has some sort of surface appeal. Our government is one, we call it a federalist government, so that rights that are not granted to the federal government are reserved to the states. That's in the Constitution. However, states' rights have been invoked over decades in many types of discrimination or equal rights situations. States' rights was invoked for women's rights, for racial issues. I think in today's world, if someone were to argue that the states should be able to decide whether racial discrimination is legal or not, or discrimination, specifically sex discrimination on the basis of gender, should be decided on a state-by-state basis, I don't know that there'd be a lot of support for that argument. We may find 10 years, 20 years, 50 years down the road that the people who are arguing that transgendered rights should be decided on a state-by-state basis are going to be relegated to the dustbins of history in the same way that the 1960s states' rights advocates are.
All right. Great perspective. Thomas Wassell is a labor and employment attorney.
Very, very interesting, Lori. I know you've been checking out what's trending on social media with regards to this transgender issue, which I believe has to be front and center.
It is, actually. Actually, hashtag trans rights just started trending. And, you know, following the administration's reversal of those federal guidelines telling public schools to not let transgenders anymore use the restrooms, teens. Jackie Evancho, now she is a teenager who actually sang the national anthem at President Trump's inauguration.
Yeah. Yeah.
She tweeted directly to the president today saying, at Real Donald Trump, you gave me the honor to sing at your inauguration. Please give me and my sis the honor to meet with you to talk hashtag transgender rights. Now, her sister is a transgender teen.
Right, yeah, yeah, so. Yeah. I saw them interviewed. And, you know, when Jackie was asked, was she comfortable in singing at the inauguration, she said, well, I'm comfortable. Well, she's 16 years old. She said, I'm comfortable because I love my country.
Right.
That's how she answered that. So it'll be interesting if he'll let her come to the Oval Office.
Sean Spicer today in the press briefing said he seemed to indicate the president would do just that. But, she's getting some mixed reactions on social media. Some people like this person, Capital Talk or Kappa Talk P, said that she's a perfect example of standing up only when it affects you personally. She knew who she performed for at the inauguration. So I guess, people are saying, but, look, she was trying to be patriotic,
Right. Exactly. I certainly a topic that will continue to top the mind of many, many people else. Anything else out there trending?
Unfortunately, yes. They're a very sad day for the folks over at Fox News. The cable network announced that their longtime contributor, Alan Colmes, died after a brief illness. He was only 66. Now, he provided a liberal voice to Fox. He was a longtime co-host of the show Hannity and Colmes. His colleague on that show, at Sean Hannity, talked about his passing, saying he was civil, he was kind, he was the staunchest supporter of freedom of speech I've ever met. It's like a part of me left today. It has been a really tough day.
Yeah, it's very sad news. And I always thought it was unique because Hannity, the conservative of the two, got along so well with him on the air. And Colmes held tight to his beliefs.
He did, but he was always cordial about it.
He was cordial about it. That seems like from another era, doesn't it? Huh?
Yes, for sure, for sure. A lot of well-known names, too, have been talking about that very thing. Michael Reagan, son of the late President Ronald Reagan, tweeted, Alan Colmes was a dear friend. I will miss him in our talks. We spoke every Thanksgiving and Christmas. Former Fox News personality Megyn Kelly tweeted, heartbroken, my friend Alan Colmes has died. He lit up the Fox News Channel halls with his kindness and humor, incredibly positive force. And, it's interesting, even PETA, that's People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, tweeted.
Really?
Alan Colmes and his heart for animals will be missed. He talked on his shows about circus cruelty, trophy hunting, vegan food benefits, and more. So
amazing.
He'll be sorely missed. I saw him in the hallways. I used to work there for quite a few years.
Oh, did you? Okay.
And I didn't know him, but very, very, just very down-to-earth, kind person. If he'd see you, no pretensions.
Well, it's sad to know that he's gone. Lori, you're wonderful. Thank you so much. That's International Edition's Lori London. By the way, you can find Lori on Twitter at Lori London, and I'll spell it LORILUNDIN. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and our program, International Edition, can be found at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Iraq said Thursday that the U.S.-backed forces had retaken the airport in Mosul that had been controlled by the group Islamic State since 2014. We get the latest now from Edward Uranian at the VOA Middle East Bureau.
Iraqi government forces moved into Mosul International Airport as tanks and armored personnel carriers surrounded runways alongside the main terminal building. A commander with the Iraqi police brigade, which stormed the airport, told Iraqi media that he was standing on the main runway and that the airport's terminal building was to the side of him. It was not clear from the video if government forces were inside. State TV reported that 90% of the main terminal was damaged in the assault. A second Iraqi commander told journalists that his forces were preparing for the next phase of the battle, which entails going deeper into parts of Mosul beyond the airport. Iraqi Interior Minister Qasem al-Araji, who accompanied the Federal Police Brigade and the Rapid Deployment Force, which captured the airport, sounded optimistic. He says that Iraqis have shown that they have a will to win and that their morale remains very high. Iraqi military spokesman General Saad Man told State TV that the operation to retake the airport had gone much more quickly than expected. He says that 10 days of planning went into the operation, but that it took only 2.5 days to capture the airport. He maintained that Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi had given orders to his military and police commanders to place civilians above all military considerations. Interior Minister Araji said civilians in the area around the airport have remained in their homes and would be safe. Military commanders touring the area with him noted that the Busayf district beyond the airport was their next target. The military spokesman also said a nearby power plant was captured in the operation. Thursday's assault on the airport and Ghazlani military base on the edge of southern Mosul is part of a major operation that began earlier this week to rout Islamic State forces from western Mosul. Iraqi forces liberated eastern Mosul last month from Islamic State, which captured the city in 2014. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
International NGO is working to make sure that the nearly 2 million people with disabilities in South Sudan get aid relief. Light for the World says even the estimated 250,000 living in internally displaced people's camps have basic services. They lack those. They don't have enough infrastructure. Malte Fenders is the program coordinator for South Sudan for that group. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the situation.
Well, in South Sudan, there has been a crisis, a critical humanitarian situation now since civil war broke out again 3 years ago. And there's a lot of internally displaced persons moving around in the country. From this, about 1.65 million. There are around 250,000 people with disabilities in the IDP camps. So they are very much affected by the civil war and also by the famine. Well, imagine the life in these camps that a person with disability has to cope with, spending whole day waiting in line for access for nutrition and so on. The life world of a person with disability in these camps is really challenging.
Yes, you mentioned one of the big challenges, and that is getting access to the food and having to stand in long lines if you have a disability. There are other issues as well. Can you talk about some of the other challenges that people with disabilities in South Sudan are facing right now?
Access to education and medical care also is a huge problem for persons with disabilities all over South Sudan. Light for the World is more concentrated on the southern part of South Sudan, so we are engaged in supporting persons with disabilities in internally displaced people camps around Juba. We already supported there the food distribution to make sanitary facilities accessible, but also support inclusive education in mainstream schools to do some rehabilitation program with partners that are located in central Equatoria and in western Equatoria, and also to give some primary eye care support in southern parts of South Sudan.
And looking at the situation that they are facing right now, there are also some challenges regarding specific diets and even how the food is administered to them. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
The situation is that farmers have been unable to tend their crops while more and more internally displaced persons are moving into already overcrowded refugee camps. As the camps are more in rural regions, it is not so easy to reach there. As Light for the World, supporting organizations that are active in humanitarian response with disability mainstreaming training, so to say that the organizations do monitor if persons with disabilities receive supplies, if they get utensils that they need to eat, if there is additional high-energy food available, that persons with disabilities who may need specific diets or special liquid-based supplements, that they are supported. Of course, also, if they have family members or need an extra assistance to support.
Walta Vanders is Program Director for South Sudan for the group Light for the World. He was speaking with Kim Lewis, who hosts the VOA program Africa News Tonight. Well, we're going to shift gears a bit now and talk about the Academy Awards. Five films are nominated for Best Foreign Language Film this year. VOA's David Byrd tells us the subject matter ranges from a tribal love story to a gripping World War II drama to a poignant drama from Iran.
Of the five films nominated for the Best Foreign Language Oscar, none has won either a BAFTA in Britain or a Golden Globe here in the United States. So the Oscar field is wide open. Australia's entry, Tana, tells a Romeo and Juliet-style story set on a South Pacific island. The film's Australian director, Bentley Dean, said he wanted to go back to Tana to make a movie ever since he went there more than 10 years ago to make a documentary.
Had a brief window of opportunity between projects and convinced my wife to come live with me and with my two small children and try and make a film collaborating with the local community, and reconnected with the tribes over there and went and visited and say, you know, what do you think? You know, do you want to make a film together? And they said, yeah.
The Danish movie Land of Mine recounts the true story of teenage German prisoners of war who were made to clear mines from the coasts of Denmark after World War II. Martin Sandvliet, who directed the film, said it caused a lot of soul-searching in Denmark.
It brought out a lot of debate. The historians came out of their little holes, so to speak, and it brought out a big debate in the media whether it was right to treat the Germans like this or whether it was facts or whether it was fiction or whether I have gone fictionalized it too much or whether all these things that is interesting for a movie.
Sweden's A Man Called Ove tells the story of a disagreeable old man who keeps trying to hang himself so he can be reunited with his late wife. But when a young Iranian woman moves into his neighborhood, his perspective changes. The film is based on the novel by Frederick Bachmann. Actor Rolf Lassgård, who plays Ova, says the novel informed the choices he made in the film.
Of course, you could feel the pressure, but pressure is something good to have on you. So, I used the book as an actor, because you can find a lot of good stuff that you can use in the shoot.
Germany's Toni Erdmann is a father-daughter comedy that also pokes fun at sexism, greed, and family relationships. The film won the Fipreski Prize, given by critics at the Cannes Film Festival. Director Marin Ade says she has been almost overwhelmed by the movie's success.
It's nice, and it's so, I mean, I enjoy that the film is released in so many countries. It's really something that you dream of when you do a film. It's what you do the film for, that it has a own second life with the audience. It's a crazy time, and the year's almost gone now. I don't know, yeah.
Iran's entry is The Salesman, from director Asghar Farhadi. It tells the story of a theater couple whose lives are turned upside down when the wife is attacked in their apartment. Farhadi, whose film A Separation won the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar in 2012, will not be attending the Oscars because of the Trump administration's ban on travel from Iran and six other Muslim-majority countries. Though that ban has been temporarily overturned in U.S. courts, the president has announced plans to issue a new order soon. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Also, we should note, after 2 years of intense public scrutiny over the Academy's all-white nominating activities, the 2017 Oscar nominees are a diverse group this year. Denzel Washington up for his 7th nomination for Best Actor for the film Fences. In all, there are 6 African-American actors nominated. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been more than 3 years since thousands of Ukrainians first came together in Kyiv's central square, the Maidan, to protest the refusal of then-President Viktor Yanukovych to heed their desire for democratic reform, rule of law, and European integration. This gathering ended with Yanukovych fleeing Ukraine after the failure of his government's attempts to suppress the will of the people by force. In a statement marking the anniversary of Ukraine's revolution of dignity, State Department acting spokesperson Mark Toner praised the remarkable progress Ukraine has made since that time to fulfill the promise of the Maidan. He urged Ukraine's leaders to strengthen efforts to fight corruption and to continue the political and economic reforms that will honor those who gave their lives to secure a better, more democratic future for Ukraine. And he pledged that the United States will continue to be a partner in such efforts. In an address at the United Nations Security Council, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley also spoke of the strength of the Ukrainian people, saying the demonstrators who urged an end to corruption and demanded freedom and democracy more than 3 years ago succeeded in creating a new Ukraine. As she noted, since that time, Russia has tried to thwart the new direction of the Ukrainian people by occupying and attempting to annex Crimea, and by arming, financing, and organizing separatist forces in eastern Ukraine, leading to a devastating conflict that has cost more than 10,000 lives. Ambassador Haley pointed to the pictures of destruction that have emerged recently from the town of Avdiivka as clear evidence of the consequences of Russia's ongoing interference in Ukraine. The United States, said Ambassador Haley, thinks it's possible to have a better relationship with Russia. After all, she noted, we confront many of the same threats. But greater cooperation with Russia cannot come at the expense of the security of our European friends and allies. She urged Russia to show a commitment to peace by fully implementing the commitments under the Minsk Agreement and ending its occupation of Crimea. She said the United States and the EU will retain sanctions on Russia until those commitments are met, and that the separate Crimea-related sanctions imposed by the United States will remain until Russia returns control over the peninsula to Ukraine. The United States, said Ambassador Haley, continues to stand with the Ukrainian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.